Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord, your occasional regular substitute host on the Sunday morning wake-up call. Thank you. It is a lovely August morning, if you don't mind the heat. I am sitting here live in the studio across from John Unsworth. John, good morning.
Morning.
Feel get comfortable with your microphone. We're going to be here for a while. John is the new dean of the library at the University of Virginia. And I should say right up front, full disclosure, when I'm not here at the radio station and doing my theater things, I'm also an employee at the university library. So you're like my boss's 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 boss. So I'll try not to brown nose too much. I brought you in here because I think people will be interested in your story and also just what's going on at the library at the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia, obviously, you know, big dog in town, and the library, a big dog at the university. So welcome. You've been here. You came in late June, back when you were appointed as dean of the library. So you've been here not quite 2 months. What is that, like 6-7 weeks?
Yeah, about 6 weeks.
But you have a long history with the University of Virginia. This is kind of coming home for you. You were a graduate. You were tenured faculty. Let you tell your own story. I don't have to tell your story because when you came in as a candidate for this position, I know there were a lot of people who went, John Unsworth. Wait, we've heard that name before. So who is John Unsworth and what is your association with the University of Virginia?
Well, you're right. I was here first as a graduate student in the English department in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I came here after doing a master's at Boston University to do the English PhD. Was here for 6 years in that program, mm-hmm. which, believe it or not, was fast.
Sure.
For an English PhD. And also spent a year here as a lecturer after I finished the PhD.
So for people, I mean, half the people in town work at the university, but, yes. But for the other half that don't, what is a lecturer and how is a lecturer distinct from, you know, a faculty or full-time professor?
So lecturers can be part-time or full-time. I was a full-time lecturer. They're not on the tenure track, which means they're on, you know, 1, 2, or 3 year contracts. I was on a 1 year contract. And I was teaching 3 and 3, six different preparations, six different courses. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, at the end of that year, I wondered why it took me so long to finish my PhD. I was so terrified. I was writing 150 pages of lecture notes a week.
Wow.
Just to make sure that I had a script. And it was probably some of the worst teaching of my life. Since I'm on the radio now, I want to apologize to any students who took any of those six courses.
What would those courses have been? Do you remember?
Oh, God, yes. They had unintimidating titles like Modern Thought, Descartes to Nietzsche. That was one. Mm. Post-war American fiction. I did a couple large lecture courses and one small seminar each semester. I had three little kids at the time.
Wow.
They grew up here, really. I mean, we left for 4 years after that, but then came back in 1993 as director of the Institute for Advanced Technology in the Humanities.
IATH. That's an institute that's been around for a while. People mm-hmm. may have heard of it, but you were the founding director.
That's correct.
Yeah. So tell us about IATH.
So IATH was a really interesting project that arose, as I understand it, out of an offer from IBM to computer science faculty, Bill Wolf. Mm-hmm. Bill had just stepped down, I think, as head of the National Science Foundation and had not yet stepped up as head of the National Academy of Engineering. They offered him some in-kind and direct contributions for basically anything that he wanted to do, and it was his idea really to put that technological gift on the humanities.
And we should put this in context with the time. This is early 90s.
Yeah, this would be 1992.
Probably. Right. So the web, as we know it, hadn't really emerged yet. It was just starting to sort of crack the eggshell.
Just barely. I mean, it burst on the scene in 1994.
Right.
So that was a couple of years before the web.
Right. So before we truly sort of had a full understanding of what a digital life might mean.
We don't yet.
Yeah. So, Fair enough.
But it was early in the engagement of scholarship with that level of technology, although I have to say there's a very long history of engagement between scholarship and technology that goes back. I've traced it back to 1851. That's the earliest I can get.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to write that down. I want to hear more about that. But let's continue on with IATH.
So IATH existed and still exists in order to work with faculty in the humanities on research involving information technology as a research tool,
mm-hmm.
and we worked with projects across the disciplines. We worked with faculty at Virginia and elsewhere. We started a lot of projects that people may recognize, not because of IATH, but because they know the project. So the Rossetti Archive, the Blake Archive, lots of collections focused on particular authors and their output and all of the stages of that output. So the manuscripts were, in the case of Rossetti, paintings and drawings, as well as poems. And so those things were... we might now call them digital incunabula. They were handmade digital projects.
One might.
From the early days. And those projects are still around. And, actually one of the things that I think IATH has to be proud about is that in a world where information technology changes on six-month cycles and goes through major upheavals, it's a real accomplishment to have been able to take a long view of information architecture and design these projects in a way that would hold up to decades of effort. So these projects are now, some of them concluded, some of them still going after 15 years or more, and the fact that they're able to work in a technological framework that was designed 15 years ago is a remarkable accomplishment, actually.
I agree. We're talking to John Unsworth, the Dean of the UVA Library. You're listening to the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I should clear my throat. Okay, so you were at IATH for, I would say, 6-7 years?
10 years.
Oh, my goodness. It was longer than I realized.
That was 1993 to 2003.
Oh, okay. And then sadly, you left us for a while.
Well, it was time to do something new.
That's sad for you.
Something
sad
new.
For us.
You wouldn't have wanted me to stick around. I went from here to the University of Illinois, where I spent 9 years as dean of their Graduate School of Library and Information Science. Not running a library, but running a professional school where librarians are educated. And we had lots of students in a master's program. About half of them were getting their master's online in a online program that had been developed beginning in 1995, I think, or 96 was when they taught their first class.
Wow. Okay. So now what we, the conversation in the air the past 2 years in academic circles has been about MOOCs,
mm-hmm.
And these, I don't remember, massive online.
Mm-hmm.
what's the rest stand for? Massive online something. Yeah, online classes. The MOOCs were sort of part of the discussion when we had our recent unpleasantness a couple of years ago. With the attempted ouster of the president of the university, but you said you were at a college in
University of Illinois.
University of Illinois, where they've been doing online courses since 1995.
96, I think. It was the and that wasn't the whole university. That was the library school.
Library school specifically.
Yeah.
And is that so people could get their degrees by taking mostly online courses?
Yes. That program was always designed as a what we call a hybrid program. So it had an in-person element.
Mm-hmm.
There was a boot camp at the beginning of the program, and there was a day, a semester, that we asked students to come back and sit face-to-face with the members of their class. So they did have a real-time component.
Sure.
Online. They had a face-to-face component, and it was very personal. Unlike MOOCs, it wasn't tens or hundreds of thousands of students. It was 15 or 20 students at a time.
Right, right. And that program is still going?
Still going very successfully, and top-ranked library science master's program in the country, and it has the first PhD in that area in the country that began offering the PhD in the 1940s.
Fantastic. So for all those kids who are listening in on the radio now thinking, I want to grow up to be a librarian someday.
There are those kids.
I know they are. I know there are. A lot of them now work at the library.
Some of them don't know it yet. and in fact, that's one of the challenges, I think, for librarianship as a profession. It's not as visible to the undergraduate as a career path as are, for example, business or law or medicine.
Right.
Other professions.
Right. It's one of the, I you know, work at the library. I'm not a librarian. I don't have a librarian degree, library degree, but I spoken to many people just out of curiosity, you know, how do you get into this business? The cutthroat world of librarianship. and a lot of them, the story seems to be either this is just something they always knew that they wanted to do since, you know, they were a kid and going to the local library and looking up in awe at the librarian behind the desk, or just kind of stumbled across it. You know, they were pursuing their English degree or a lot of English degrees, or their literature degree or their history degree, and spending a lot of time in the library and realizing, hey, you know, this maybe, you know, I don't really want to, you know, I'd like to stay in academia, but I don't want to teach. This is a good area, helping researchers.
It's a great profession to go into. It's got many different facets to it. It's highly technologically inflected these days. So there's, you know, plenty for people who are interested in that. It's fundamentally a service profession. And so it's really about helping people and helping people work with information.
So this looks like a good time for me to, we've got about 5 more minutes before we have to do our first underwriting. Let's talk about libraries. A lot of people maybe don't understand what libraries do these days. And why do we still need them? And who reads books anymore? So you're a good person to ask. why do we still need libraries?
Well, following on what we were just talking about, we need libraries because we need librarians. And libraries make it easy to find them. And I think, seriously, librarians are some of the most important resources that you will find in a library. People tend to focus on, you know, the physical collections, on books, and those are an important part of libraries as well. But libraries do a huge amount of work organizing licensed electronic resources now. You know, I think people have the impression that the things that, you know, they find on the web are there because they're, you know, they just somehow appeared there and they're you know, available to everybody.
But, and they're free.
And they're free. And you know, that is certainly, there's a huge amount of information that is freely available on the web. But there's a lot of information and some very important sources of information that are not freely available, that are licensed. And those things need to be organized and presented to users. And that's not as easy as it sounds. So an electronic resource librarian might have the opportunity to give users the New York Times online from maybe 5 different sources in different forms with different date ranges and different extents. And so figuring out how to make that a welter of electronic information navigable for users in that world of licensed information in particular is an important library function. But so is library consultation, you know, what we used to think of as going to the reference desk.
Right.
You know, I think I was at meeting yesterday that Terry Sullivan held for parents bringing their kids to college. She cited an experiment in engineering in which students were divided into two groups, one of whom was not given any specific instructions about the library, and the other half was told, go see a librarian and work with them on your assignment. And she recounted that the grades of the students who had worked with the librarians were a full letter grade higher than the ones, the grades of this other group that hadn't. And, you know, that's a real effect. It's an important thing about academic research libraries that some students discover and others don't.
Now back in my college days, which were a ways back, are incoming students still brought to the library? Is that part of their orientation? Are they given?
Yeah, we do a lot of what we call information literacy instruction. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in seeing that more embedded in particular courses and assignments and syllabi, and not presented as a standalone kind of instruction, because it's very hard for students to attach information like that to anything that will help them hang on to it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's in the same day you're being given a tour of the library and being given a tour of the dining hall.
Well, and, you know, if you're not actually trying to use the resources that you're being introduced to,
right,
it doesn't stick. So having library instruction embedded in the rest of your instruction works better. We have a couple of different ideas about that, including a sort of an add-on, like a library lab that the University Library Committee is recommending. We're going to try that as an experiment.
What's a library lab?
Well, it would be a one-credit add-on to a course that you're already taking that involves more in-depth work with library resources.
Oh, that's a good idea. So then they're actually getting, a student's actually getting credit for coming in and learning how to use the library.
That's the idea, and that's one model that we're going to try, and we'll try another one starting next summer, where we'll do some summer grants to faculty to work with librarians on building information literacy into their course in the way that I was talking about before.
Excellent. For those of you who are tuning in late, we're talking to John Unsworth, the new dean of the UVA Library. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord. I'm talking with John Unsworth, the dean of the UVA Library. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Okay, so we were just talking a little bit about the function of libraries. We'll get back to that, but I want to sort of go back to your biography. Where we last left you was mm-hmm. at the dean of the library school. Am I saying that right? At the University of Illinois?
Yeah. Yep, that's correct.
And so you're also a dean here at UVA, but we don't have a library school.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference?
What does it mean? Well, I'll tell you in a few months.
Okay.
Because I'm still finding out the answer to that question myself. But I think one of the things that it means is that at the University of Virginia, there are 12 libraries, 12 library locations,
mm-hmm.
and 9 of those are under my management, and 3 report elsewhere.
Right. The 3 are at the law school, the business school, and the medical center. Health sciences.
They have. They also have libraries. We collaborate. We share a lot of resources, and they contribute to library acquisitions, but they report to their deans. So I'm guessing that one of the meanings of the term dean in this context means working with those people to represent their interests in the provost office and elsewhere, and coordinating with them on policy issues and on practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I've started to meet some of those people. One, Taylor Fitchett from the law school, was on the search committee, and I'll be getting to know those people over the next couple months, and then I'll be able to tell you more about what it means to be dean of the libraries.
Fair enough. Some people might be surprised to find out that there are that many libraries at UVA. I mean, the big dogs, obviously, are Clemens Library, the Graduate Library, Alderman, the Division Library, the Special Collections Library, where I work. And then some of the smaller libraries people might be familiar with, such as the Fine Arts Library, the Music Library. There are libraries that are just rooms, like in astronomy and chemistry, where you just have a collection of titles and journals that are specific to those studies.
Yep, that's true. The 24x5 libraries, the ones that are open around the clock at least 5 days a week, are Clemens and the Science Library.
Right.
And there are different hours for these different spaces. Some of them function, as study spaces, almost more than as collection spaces. And they're shifting. You know, this chemistry library, for example, is up. That building's up for renovation.
Right.
So, you know, these things will be fluctuating. And for students, if there are students listening to the program or coming back for the academic year, we'll be distributing information about study spaces to help you navigate various construction projects and whatnot. So Clemens is getting a new roof this year.
Which is a big deal for people who spend any amount of time in Clemens.
Well, it will mean that we don't need the plastic funnels on the top floor, keeping the water channeled into buckets. So that'll be a big improvement.
That's definitely on your bucket list.
Yes.
If people want to keep up with the renovations that are going on the library, they can go to the library website. Mm-hmm. Which is, if I believe I'm having saying this right, it's just library.virginia.edu.
That is correct. And they can, you know, if they show up, for example, at Clemens 2, which is a popular study space, which is going to be closed this semester the Total Advising Project.
Let's talk about the Total Advising Project, because I'm not sure. I was going to say, I'm not sure everybody knows what that is. I don't even know entirely what that is.
Well, since I've been here now for 6 weeks, I might not be the best source of information on that, but my understanding is that this is an effort by the campus to centralize the physical location of advising services of all sorts for students and have a drop-in center that's easy to find and where you can find all different kinds of assistance. I think that's a fine idea. Clemens 2 has been a really popular study space.
Right.
So I'm glad to say that after hours, after the 9-to-5 business hours, the space will still be open after the renovation to students as study space. And really, after 5 p.m. until the wee hours of the morning is when students use the library most heavily. So I think that'll work out okay.
So all the books. Mm-hmm. What's happening to all the books on the second floor of Clemens?
The provost's office has helped with some high-density shelving on the first floor, and we'll be keeping the books in the building. In fact, we may actually increase the shelving capacity in that building a little bit in this project.
So we may lose some of the open space that's been down on the first floor, but we'll be adding more shelving?
We will add a... We may lose a little bit of that open space downstairs, but replacing regular shelving with high-density shelving expands your storage capacity quite a bit without taking up a lot more floor space.
So the construction is going to be starting, well, the demolition is going to be starting very soon.
The second floor is already cleared out and well underway. The roof project has not yet begun, but it will begin soon.
Yeah, anybody who spends any time at UVA has gotten used to construction going on.
I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. Oh, it is. I've been there for 25 years, and you know, we only just recently took down the fence that was surrounding the rotunda.
Yep.
You know, in all my 25 years, there's always been something going on, which just makes it an
that's
exciting
a sign
place
of
to
life.
Work.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about your experience at the University of Illinois and what you were doing there, and how that sort of prepped you for coming back to University of Virginia.
Sure. So one of the things that I was doing at the University of Illinois was my own research as a faculty member there. And that research for about the last 8 years has been focused on text mining in digital library collections.
What is text binding?
Text mining.
Text mining, excuse me.
Yes, like digging nuggets out of the earth. Mm-hmm. So text mining is the statistical analysis of text to detect patterns or to predict relatedness or to understand social networks. It can be used for all kinds of purposes, but basically at its core, it's a quantitative analysis, a statistical analysis of text.
And this falls under the rubric of digital humanities?
It does, in my view. I mean, text mining can be used for lots of things that have nothing to do with the humanities, but mm-hmm. it can be used in the humanities as well.
Well, what is digital humanities? Because you've gotten a few awards in that area.
So, digital humanities has a couple of important traditions that are rather different, and we can get into the nuances if you're interested. But basically, I would say digital humanities means using digital tools to do the work of the humanities. That's it.
Well, okay. It's sort of built into the phrase, isn't it?
It is.
But what are digital tools? I mean, you've talked a little bit about text mining.
Yep.
What are some of the other mining tools that we use?
Well, the tools that people use depend in part on what kind of content they're working on. So they might be working with three-dimensional data. They might be working with sound. They mm-hmm. might be working with visual data. The tools that you use in each of those cases will be different because the content types are different. The traditions that I mentioned, basically there's one that goes back to philology and the study of language, and that's some of the earliest work with computer technology in the humanities. And you can find what we would consider to be computational work going back as far as computers. So back to the 40s.
Well, you also mentioned 1851.
Yes, there you can do quantitative analysis without computers.
Yeah, well, tell me about that, because this actually does sound interesting.
So in 1851, there was a man who was a mathematician. He was corresponding with a friend of his who was cleric, mm-hmm. and discussing a thought experiment. He was interested in measuring things, all sorts of things, and he had the idea that if you counted the number of letters in the words used by different authors, you could distinguish one author from another based on their favorite number of letters. So he postulated that basically different authors would use language differently, and those differences would be sufficiently predictable to be used to distinguish authors one from another. And that just stayed as a thought experiment until after his death. His wife published his letters in a biography,
mm-hmm.
and the biography was read by a guy named Thomas Mendenhall. No relation, I think, to our football coach. But I haven't researched that yet.
You haven't asked him.
I haven't asked him. Thomas Mendenhall was one of the first faculty members at what is now Ohio State University. He was a physicist by training, or a physics high school teacher, actually before he became a university faculty member. And he was also very interested in measuring things. He was one of the first people to figure out how to measure the height of Mount Fuji, he was interested in measuring weather and was responsible for some of the technology that allowed railroads to transmit weather information. He read this thought experiment and decided to carry it out. And so he hired a couple of women from Worcester, Massachusetts, and he gave them specialized equipment that he designed.
Before we had computers, we had women from Worcester.
Women, and actually a little bit later than this, those women were actually called computers. That was a job title.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
All exclusively held by women. So these two women, one of them had in front of her the complete works of Shakespeare, and the other had what looked like an adding machine. And the first woman would read through a play, not reading the words, but calling out the number of letters in each word.
Right.
While the other person recorded that word by word.
Interesting.
And try to imagine in your mind this scene.
Yeah.
One woman shouting out, 4, 6, 3, 2, and the other person punching the numbers.
Huh.
They carried out the entire experiment, and in fact, it was true that you could distinguish Shakespeare from some other writers based on the number of letters. His favorite word turned out to be a four-letter word. Not a particular four-letter word.
Is it one you can see on the radio?
No, words of four letters were his favorite. And so there was an interesting proof of concept, which he published in Popular Science in 1901 for the first time. So I regard that as quantitative work with humanities content.
No, that's great. That's
stylistic analysis.
That's a great example. So did someone then run Francis Bacon through the same process to figure out if they...
Well, there's been a lot of work, actually. A lot of the early work in, you know, as computers became more available was done in this vein of authorship attribution or stylistic analysis. And it's gotten hugely more sophisticated. And it turns out that the real signature words for authors are the words that they don't even notice enough to know that they're using them. So it's words of two letters, it's conjunctions, it's words that don't carry a lot of semantic content that actually provide the best signature. There's a guy in Australia named John Burroughs who's done a lot of great work on this. But as you can imagine, this is a problem of limited interest. So mostly we know who wrote things. There are a few cases, and Shakespeare's a notable one, where authorship is in doubt. The Federalist Papers, Diderot's Encyclopedia, you know, there are examples of places where it would be interesting to know or where authorship is controversial. But it's not a central problem for the humanities at large. So for a while this was a central problem in what was then called humanities computing, humanities computing was a bit of an outlier for the rest of the discipline. People just didn't see much of interest there.
But I'll bet that has changed in the past 25 years.
It changed a lot with the web, and it changed a lot with the ability to publish images and to link and to deal with languages that worked with an alphabet other than the Roman alphabet. You know, early text encoding was really limited by the encoding technology, the punch card, for example.
Right.
It was very difficult. You just didn't have enough bits to work with to do complex characters. So if you worked with Latin, you know, you probably had pretty good use of the tools. But if you worked with Greek, you were out of luck.
So are there projects now? I'm going to go back to your early days at IF. Are there projects now that are part of the common parlance in the library world and the academic world, that you foresaw, that when as this kind of scholarship expanded in a direction that 25 years ago you looked and say, yeah, these are the sort of things that we can do, or has it gone off in entirely wholly different directions that people couldn't even have foreseen in the early days of the web?
I'm going to answer that either or question with yes.
yeah, so. Or both.
Yeah, both are true. I mean, there are things, you know, last time I was here, one of the things that I did was to work on incorporating a longstanding effort called the Text Encoding Initiative, which is a set of guidelines for how to encode electronic text in software-independent ways for the analysis of literary and linguistic text. And that had been a project that started in the late 80s, when personal computing and word processing software first appeared.
Right.
But people began to be concerned about embedding their work in a proprietary platform.
Right.
Like WordStar.
I remember WordStar.
And the dot command. So the text encoding initiative was a standards-based, non-proprietary way of doing this encoding and has had a big impact on the libraries and on scholarship and scholarly editions. So that, in 2000, was incorporated as a membership organization with its headquarters here in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in 2008, I mentioned that I started working on text mining projects. In 2004, Google did unveiled the Google Books project.
Yes.
Google Books project drew heavily on academic research libraries, including ours here at Virginia. And most of what's in Google Books wouldn't be there if libraries hadn't hung on to it. So, you know, when people point to Google Books and say, well, it's all online, why do we need libraries? I say, because if we didn't have them, it wouldn't be there. And so that that was a project in which universities got copies back from Google of what had been digitized. So
right.
Google did the digitization and returned the digital content to the libraries, page images and metadata and OCR'd or optical character
right.
recognition scanned text. As soon as libraries started to get that back, they realized that A, there was a lot of it, and B, it had a lot of legal issues attached to it because the bulk of it was in copyright. Another reason that we need libraries, because things that are in copyright aren't generally freely available.
Right.
So they centralized this. They set up something called the HathiTrust, which is a library effort to provide infrastructure for this. It's based at the University of Michigan, but involves now, I think, over 150 libraries.
I want to get back specifically to the HathiTrust, because we're getting into an area now that I think could use some public explanation.
Mm-hmm.
My guest is John Unsworth, the Dean of the UVA Library. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is 94.7 WPVC. This is Sean McCord. I have to apologize for my voice earlier. I guess I didn't use it enough this morning. I've been kind of croaking my way through my questions. So I'm grateful we had a little time off the air just to take a drink and clear my throat. I'll try to make it through the next 20 minutes or so. What is the HathiTrust? This is a consortium of libraries across the nation, across the globe?
Mostly U.S. libraries, although there's some Canadian libraries now, and there could be other international libraries.
Mm-hmm.
The originally, as I explained before the break, it was set up by libraries that contributed to Google Books and got stuff back from that project and needed to store it securely in a central location. They've since expanded to offer membership to libraries who didn't contribute originally to the Google Books project. And the way this works is, if you're a member of the organization, you dump your catalog records basically a couple times a year,
mm-hmm.
and send those to the HathiTrust, and then you can link from your online catalog to the full text of public domain works that you have in your physical collection. So if you have a book that was published before 1923 in the U.S. and it's out of copyright, and it's very likely to be in the HathiTrust collection, which is all monographs or books, not journals or serials,
right?
Then you can actually download the whole text of that book from the catalog system if your library has set up that affordance. And you can search other in copyright books and see snippets of content, but you can't download the whole in copyright book. So the project related to the HathiTrust that I got involved with back in 2008 is the project of building a research center around this content that would allow people to do computational work, to do text mining with not just the public domain content, but all of the content, so including the copyrighted content. And we have just gotten permission to do that last December from the three universities that are involved, Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan. And so we're beginning to do that. And since 65% of the 4 billion pages that are in this collection are in copyright, then, you know, being able to provide access to that material is a huge breakthrough.
Really. Wow. That's a lot of pages.
4 billion pages, only about half of them are in English. Hmm. It's on every subject that you would find covered in books in a research library. And the possibilities for exploring this at scale with quantitative tools is tantalizing, to say the least.
Absolutely. In addition to books that have been published and, under copyright, libraries also store, well, they both give access to research material, such as journals, but also archive research materials, such mm-hmm. as a thesis mm-hmm. That that a student may have submitted. How does a library help give access to those kinds of materials?
Well, the print materials, the books mm-hmm. and bound journals, we have in the collections at the University of Virginia somewhere north of 5 million items. Some of those are on OpenStax. There's probably a couple million items in Alderman Library.
Right. By OpenStax, you mean you can get a number and go down
in,
and
pull it off the shelf.
Right.
Yeah. And then we store an increasing amount of stuff at IvyStax, which is a near-site mm-hmm. closed storage facility from which materials can be retrieved in a matter of hours. So you can request from, find it in the catalog, see that it's at IvyStax, put in a request, and if you're a faculty member, it'll be delivered to your office.
There has been some discussion before you came on board, mm-hmm. but I'm sure you have been up to date on it, some controversy mm-hmm. about the library no longer holding books mm-hmm. or sending books away to the IvyStax. Can you explicate a little bit for us what that's about, what's actually going on?
Sure. So our library, like every library, has lots of different constituencies. Mm-hmm. We have people who value the library principally for space. A lot of undergraduate students who share housing, with someone else.
Right.
Need a place to go to study is not their dorm room. And students use the library very heavily for that. Other people really value the library for its physical collections. And still other people, or some of the same of both, perhaps value the library for the librarians that I talked about earlier were in there. So, we also function as a public library. In some respects, we are a public library, and members of the community can walk in and use the collections mm-hmm. and the space just like anyone else, and they do.
And I'm surprised, a lot of people do, yeah. but I'm also surprised at the number of people who don't know that, who think that the university library is only open to students and faculty.
No, if you have a Virginia ID, mm-hmm. you're welcome to use the library. And so the controversy that you mentioned earlier is around the print collections, and the people who value the print collections most highly tend to be in the humanities, to some extent in the social sciences, and even in some disciplines that we would think of as scientific. In my experience, people in math and people in chemistry value the print record perhaps more than some of their colleagues in the sciences. But for the people in the humanities, let's say, who are the core constituency of the print collection in libraries, they've seen a lot of change. They've seen things that have been done that they didn't feel respected the print collections or respected their priority on those collections. So they've seen things discarded that they didn't think should be discarded, or they've seen, things digitized in ways that seemed not to be aware of what was important about the artifact.
And when you say discarded, do you mean actually deacquired?
Deaccessioned is the technical term.
Thank you. That was the word I was looking for.
Technical term for it. And libraries do this all the time, and they have to do this, because if they didn't do this, we'd have to stop buying new things, and
right.
we can't do that.
Right.
It is true that, you know, libraries have things that, you know, are useful for a while and then not that important anymore. We might have, you know, old SAT prep books, for example. and while I'm sure that someone could make an argument for their historical significance, you know, we would probably weigh that against other things that we were trying to decide whether to keep and keep available in the OpenStax. Or So libraries have to make decisions all the time about collections. It's not like you just buy it, you put it on the shelf, and that's it. The collection itself is an organic thing, and it's always changing. So I think, you know, the concerns are legitimate. There are, you know, there are examples of things that have happened here and elsewhere that give rise to that concern, and I understand it. On the other hand, even in a renovated Alderman Library, even in the best of all possible worlds, we're not likely to be able to keep all of the print in one place in open browsable stacks, again, unless we just stop buying print for the future.
What can you tell us about the renovation of the Alderman Library?
Well, I'm happy to say that that an initial chunk of funding has been approved by the state. It won't kick in for a few months, and it's intended to cover planning, and particularly planning around life safety issues. So the library has some life safety issues.
What are life safety issues?
Well, for example, this is a building that is still very full of paper.
Right.
And full of people.
Yes.
And has no sprinkler systems.
And both of whom are flammable.
Yes. One more than the other.
Yeah.
There are no sprinklers. And in fact, in the stacks where all the paper is, the ceiling height is 7 feet. The stacks are structural. The floors are poured concrete. And if you put a sprinkler system in there, you'd have to close the stacks or give people hard hats if they were over about 6'3".
Right, because the sprinkler system comes down from the ceiling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's basic safety issue. You would never build a building now, you know, without a sprinkler system, especially not that a building that was going to be full of students and full of paper.
Right.
So those are, and, you know, there are other issues that are less obvious than that because they're buried in the walls of a building that was erected in 1938. And, you know, there are corroded pipes and there are, you know, electrical issues. You do not want to look at the circuit panels in this building. It's frightening. It, you know, it genuinely is.
So what's going to be done? What's the scope of the project?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, depending on, you know, what we learn about the state's willingness to do the project. And there's going to be a lot of negotiation in the answering that question. But essentially, this is a building that needs to be gut renovated at this point. And made useful for the next 100 years. And that is a project that will take many years. It will take private funding as well as state funding. And it's probably going to be the centerpiece of you know, what I do while I'm here in this job. So if I could tell you now what all it was going to entail, that would be great.
But we're still figuring that out.
We're still figuring that out.
My guest who's figuring that out is John Unsworth, the dean of the UVA Library. So once we begin that renovation, a lot of books are going to have to move, even if only temporarily.
Yep. So we're doing an expansion to Ivy Stacks.
Right.
So we can hold everything that's in Alderman temporarily there. And then what comes back, I think, you know, ought to be the outcome of a conversation with faculty and students and others, in which we determine some criteria that would tell us whether a book can be in Ivy or does it need to be in the browsable stacks ready to hand.
Right, and even if it's out at Ivy, it means that you can't walk over to its location and pull it off the open stacks, but you can put in a request and the book can be there in a matter of hours, depending on the time of the day that you put in your request.
Which in general terms seems like it ought to satisfy everybody. But in fact, there are specific cases where that's not quite good enough. You know, so I think if For example, if the book's on a department's PhD orals list, and you know it's going to be frequently used by students who are, and they just need to consult it. You know, an orals list doesn't tell you what books you have to pick. It just tells you the books among which you can choose.
Right.
So, you know, having been there as a graduate student, I remember you wanted to look at those books before you put them on your list and, you know something about what you were getting into. So there are reasons like that to have books on browsable stacks. Books that are important to undergrads should probably be in browsable stacks because, I hate to say this, but, you know, sometimes there isn't that much time elapsed between when that student wants a book and when the assignment is due. You know, if they have to request something and it takes a while to get there, they'll probably move on and look for, you know, a different source. So there are all kinds of reasons, actually, that I can imagine for wanting to bring things back. Maybe a particular book has interesting copy level characteristics that would be difficult to see through a catalog record.
Right.
So there's a guy in the English department, a colleague of mine there, Andy Stouffer, who's been working for some time now on a project called Book Traces.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think this is one of our more interesting projects. Please tell us more about Book Traces.
Book Traces is about annotations in library books. And Andy's looking at monographs, again, you know, what we think of as a book on a single subject.
Right.
He's looking at books that are before the copyright era, so pre-1923. And he's looking particularly at annotations that were done by people who owned the books before they were given to the university.
So annotation, you mean people actually writing in the marginalia of of the books.
Yep, and he's digitized a lot of these annotated pages. You can find it if you just Google Book Traces, you'll find the project. And it's, I think it's a very interesting project at this library because after the Rotunda fire in 1895 destroyed most of the collection that we then had, which is about 80,000 volumes at that point before the fire and 17,000 after, the collection was rebuilt over the next decades, largely through gifts. So, there were major gifts that came from families with names that you would recognize from buildings and other things around campus.
So these were books that were owned by other people, not just originally bought by the library.
No, and so the books, for decades, up until the 30s and the 40s, that's where most of our books probably came from.
So they have the books have lives of their own.
The books had lives before they came to the library, and our collection is composed, you know, there's a certain stratum of our collection that's heavily composed of these gift collections.
Yeah.
And, you know, what he's found in these books is, you know, personal to the owners of the books. You know, it's their meditations, it's their it's the history of their reading. And that's really, you know, what I think Andy's interested in is understanding reading as a practice in the past.
You mentioned to me off air, I'm reminded that when I went back to my elementary school, like 20 years after I graduated, to go visit an old teacher, and I walked into the library, and I thought, I wonder if they still have my favorite book. I must have read this book, you know, checked out the same book every few months. And so I asked the librarian, and we went over to the library shelf and found it, and we pulled it off. And this is back in the days where there was a card in it, and you put your name, there was a little piece of paper in there, and put your name in it. And my name was still on that card, which was kind of cool, but also saddened me that so few people had read that book. You mentioned that when you were a graduate student, there was a program started to barcode books, and that they were they would barcode rather than try to go through and barcode everything. They would barcode books as they were checked out.
Well, they barcoded the frequently circulating materials as a group at the beginning of the project, but then there's a lot of stuff in libraries that doesn't circulate very often.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. There are books still, I mean,
and there's still books in the collection that haven't come out to the desk because nobody's checked them out
or in 30 plus years. Yeah.
And they haven't been barcoded. Yeah. It's single digits, you know, the percentage of any academic research library collection that circulates in a given year.
Right.
So it's, you know, this isn't really surprising. And, you know, some of what libraries do is to, you know, to buy things for the long run. And, you know, that 30, 40, 50 years ago, there were libraries, especially, you know, wealthy academic libraries like Harvard, that could buy everything on spec, basically. But even they can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much being published that it's just not it's not feasible to collect everything. So
and also put everything in OpenStax.
Yeah. No, it's the curve on the production of information is you know, really outpacing the curve on say the cost of real estate. So yeah, we all now face choices that maybe some of us didn't face 50 years ago, but got to make decisions.
We have a few seconds left. Do you have any closing thoughts that you want to give to people about the UVA library or what your large plans are?
Just going forward, you know, I think the role of the library is basically to make yesterday's information available tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll still be our mission. Within that mission, there's a lot of choices to be made. And I hope to make those choices in consultation with the people who care about the content and care about that future.
The person who cares about our content and our future is John Unsworth, the Dean of the UVA Library. John, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
This is a talk I've been wanting to have with you, and I hope that our listeners have found this information to be enlightening and useful as well.
I hope so.
This is Sean McCord on the Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.